cultivate our motivation. We may spend a good deal of time each day looking outside, asking, how are people treating me? Are they nice enough to me? Are they respectful enough to me? Do they like me? Do they not like me? Are they being fair to me? Are they cheating me? So always looking outside and trying to evaluate other people's actions. Trying to assess other people's actions, other people's motivations. And our job actually is to turn it around and investigate our own actions and our own motivations. And instead of worrying about if other people like us and if they think well of us, to ask ourselves if we are treating other people with kindness, if we are treating them with respect. Because trying to evaluate other people's actions, useless pursuit. We can't control them, we don't know their motivations, and in any case, reputation is really kind of useless. But if we pay attention to our own actions, because that's what leaves the karmic imprints that influence our future experiences and our future liberation and enlightenment, we start paying attention to what we're doing and not doing, then we can really make our lives useful and have something meaningful at the end of the day, rather than frittering our time away, consumed with what others think. And instead, when we think of other living beings, instead of wondering what they think of us, to try and have a kind heart towards them. That doesn't depend on what they think of us or how they act towards us or anything else, but simply recognizing that they're like us, wanting happiness and not suffering. And so training our mind to see them in kindness and to respond to them with kindness. And to enhance this attitude of kindness and the determination to work for their benefit fully until it becomes the altruistic intention, seeking enlightenment for their benefit. So let's cultivate that intention, that motivation now. Even this little fly who's bugging me, to not think about what he's doing to me, but to think about my attitude towards him. Okay. So, we finished the section last time about the process of cultivating the bodhicitta concerned with attaining the fully awakened state of mind. And in that section, what we did was, we, based on the cultivating the first intention, which was to work for others' welfare, we then generated the second intention, which is to attain enlightenment in order to do that most effectively. Right? Okay. So now we're going into another section that is called Instructions Concerning the Five Precepts That Are Factors of the Training. So these are five kinds of advice that are factors of the thought training. And so these are very practical aspects of how we actually train our mind. And so having generated the bodhicitta, or even aspiring to generate the bodhicitta, wanting to attain enlightenment, then, these are five practices that will help us maintain whatever altruistic intention we've developed so far and enhance what hasn't been developed. Like we're always dedicating at the end our bodhicitta prayer. So these five practices. The first one is transforming adverse circumstances into the path. Okay. The second one is the integrated practice of a single lifetime. The third is the measure of having trained the mind. The fourth, the commitments of mind training. And the fifth, the precepts of mind training. So those are five subsections here. And so now we're going to speak of the first subsection, which was transforming adverse circumstances into the path. So this is a very, very important practice because there's lots of adverse circumstances, aren't there? And if every time we had an adverse circumstance, we crumbled, we would never get anywhere in our spiritual practice, because samsara is nothing but adverse circumstances. Okay? So if we're expecting that we're in samsara and we don't have adverse circumstances, then somehow we've got it all wrong. If we're expecting to be in samsara and everything to be conducive, perfect conditions to practice dharma practice, then we're out of touch with reality, aren't we? Why are we expecting samsara to be perfect with all the right conditions for practice? We do expect that, don't we? But isn't it a rather foolish expectation? Because if we had all the perfect conditions, then since those perfect conditions arise due to causes, if we had perfect conditions, it means we would have created perfect causes, which means we would have had wisdom and compassion already and would not have had ignorance, anger, and attachment. In other words, we would have already been somewhere high on the path already. Okay? But if we look at our own mind, we're not there. Yeah? So why do we expect to have the results that the Aryas have when we haven't created the cause, because we don't have that level of mind? Okay? So we have to, put our feet on the earth sometime here. Yeah? You know that mind that says, I'm having so much trouble in my dharma practice. If I only went to this place, it would be better, And when we're out, when we're working in the community, then we think, oh, I'll wait until I go to retreat, then I can practice dharma. And then when we're in retreat, we think, oh, but I should be out working in the world. That's how I really show my bodhicitta. And so then we stop retreat and we go working in the world. When we're working in the world, our mind gets confused. We go, oh, I really should go back to the monastery and study in the monastery. And then we're back studying at the monastery, working in the monastery. We say, oh, it's too busy here and there's too much to learn. I can't learn it all. I want to go do retreat because otherwise I won't have any realizations when I die. And so you see how the dissatisfied mind keeps going round and around? Yeah? Yeah, thinking I'll be able to practice in this other circumstance that I don't currently have. And so that's why I can't practice very well now, because I'm not in that really excellent, wonderful circumstance. Yeah, it's the fault of the environment, isn't it? That's why I can't practice. It's the fault of the environment. Too many difficulties, too many adverse circumstances. And so we just sit there and kind of suck our thumb and feel sorry for ourselves. You're not laughing. This must be striking home.
Okay.
Because I've seen for years, you know, kind of, you go to India and then everybody's always saying, oh, you know, my practice is really going to begin when I go and study with this and such a lama. And then they go there and then you see them a year later and they're saying, oh, that was nice, but my practice is really going to begin when I go and do 3-year retreat. And then they start 3-year retreat. Then you see them a year later and they say, oh, that was nice, but too many obstacles. My practice is really going to begin when I go, you know, and work for Mother Teresa. Then they do that for a while, you know, and then they say, oh, that was nice, but, you know, I really need to learn to benefit to meditate better. My practice is going to begin when I go to Burma. You know, that they have a good meditative tradition, I'll learn there. Then they go to Burma. Oh, there's so many difficulties with the visa. You know, I can't stay there, too many difficulties. You know, I need to go to somewhere else. Okay. It's called The Grass is Greener on the Other Side of the Meditation Hall. Okay. So, you know, in the example I gave, all the adverse circumstances are basically in our own mind. Okay. Now, there are sometimes adverse circumstances that happen in the environment, but they only become adverse circumstances if our mind treats them like that. And what this part of the path is doing is it's going to show us how to not see those things as adverse circumstances, but to transform them so that they become part of the path to enlightenment. Yeah. Okay. So, this has two parts, the brief and the elaborate explanations. And so the text says, and so here's the from the 7-point thought transformation, when the environment and its inhabitants overflow with unwholesomeness, transform adverse circumstances into the path to enlightenment. Okay? So our author says, the environment is filled with circumstantial results of the 10 unwholesome actions, and the sentient beings who inhabit it think of nothing but disturbing emotions and do nothing but unwholesome deeds. You're going to go, well, okay, it's filled with circumstantial results of the 10 unwholesome actions. I mean, that's why there's environmental pollution. That's why we don't have decent gun laws in this country. That's why people pick up guns and just do whatever they want with them. That's why we have, you know, a judicial system that imprisons more people than any other industrialized country, you know, on and on and on. Okay? So the circumstantial results of the 10 unwholesome actions. And then the sentient beings who inhabit the environment. Here it says, think of nothing but disturbing emotions. You might say, well, think of nothing. No, once in a while they have a virtuous thought. But, you know, basically, our culture is based on greed, isn't it? Yeah? I mean, there's a lot of kindness in the world, but the whole culture is based on greed and on consumerism. And we've got to, our economy's got to keep growing every year. If it doesn't grow as much as we want it to go, it's called the recession. It's still growing, but not as much as you want it to. So it's called the recession. Okay, so, you know, just constantly producing more and more things, and we buy into it, and we need this, and we need that, okay, and want this, and want that, and complain about this, and complain about that. Who was I talking to recently? Somebody who had the same experience that I did of living in third world countries, and seeing that people there, despite the poverty, are actually happier than here in the U.S. Yeah, quite amazing. Okay, so what makes us unhappy? This mind that is never satisfied. And in some ways, the mind that has the luxury to pout. Yeah? You know, we always say about our parents' generation, you know, that they weren't very open and they couldn't talk openly and things like that. But if we look, at least my parents' generation, they grew up in the Depression. You know, when you grew up in the Depression, there's no time to go to self-help seminars. Yeah? And my grandma was telling me how she would not eat and pretend that she ate so that her kids would have food to eat. You know, when you live in that kind of situation, you don't have time to, you know, self-reflect about, you know, what's my inner child doing, because you're trying to keep your external children alive. Yeah? And if we look at our ancestors, you know, if you're in a covered wagon, I mean, my family wasn't in the country then. Some of your families were, you know, may have gone across in covered wagons or what. When you're running a covered wagon, you know, you don't have time to have a group therapy session, you know, or to get in touch with your feelings. You're just trying to stay alive. Okay, if you're Native American and there's other people coming in your area and you don't know what they're going to do, you're just trying to stay alive. So sometimes, you know, because we have so much leisure now, we misuse it. And we become so, you know, kind of hypervigilant and supersensitive to incredibly small things. You know, that people who are just trying to stay alive, they don't have the time to think about those things. Okay? So the time we have, if we use it really well, it's incredible opportunity for Dharma practice. But if we don't use it well, it just becomes time to ruminate. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah? You know rumination? Why do we know rumination? Ruminate. Okay. As to the sentient beings, think of nothing but disturbing emotions and do nothing but unwholesome deeds. And if we look around, you know, what we talk about in the newspaper all day, you know, killing and stealing and unwise sexual behavior and lying and taking intoxicants and harsh words and divisive speech. I mean, the 10 non-virtues are right there every day on the front page. And also when we look around in our lives too, there's so much of that kind of stuff going around. Yeah. So for these reasons, the gods, the nagas, and the hungry spirits who favor unwholesome actions. So the other living beings who are kind of, you know, have their own problems and like to stir up trouble, when we're busy stirring up trouble, then they are invigorated and increase in their power and strength. And as a result, spiritual practitioners in general are troubled by many interferences. And those who have entered the door of the great vehicle are beset by various adverse factors. Okay, so some of the difficulties may come from non-human beings, especially in this Tibetan kind of cultural view. Yeah, in our Western cultural view, we don't necessarily believe in spirits. You might say bad vibes, or you might just say obnoxious human beings. You know, forget about spirits. There's enough problem with human beings, aren't there? Okay, so, and as a result, practitioners, and especially Mahayana practitioners, have many obstacles and hindrances. You know, we get sick, we have an unhappy mind, we can't get our visas, we, you know, there's so many things that come up and create problems. Okay, so under such circumstances, if you engage in this kind of practice and are able to transform hostile influences into conducive circumstances, to see opponents as supporters and harmful elements as spiritual friends, you will be able to use adverse conditions as supporting factors in the attainment of enlightenment. Okay, so if we're able to practice well, then hostile influences, bad circumstances, opponents, okay, harmful elements, you know, any kind of external problem that we may face, we will be able to use it as a supporting condition to help us progress along the path. So you can see why this kind of practice is very important. Yeah. Anybody here not have hindrances? We have lots of hindrances, don't we? Huh? External hindrances, internal hindrances. Okay. So in this context, Geshe Chenghua said to Geshe Sowoba, "It is amazing that your disciples of mind training take support from adverse factors and experience sufferings as happiness." So when you practice well, when suffering happens, instead of moaning and groaning that you have a problem, you say, "Oh, this is fantastic. This gives me the chance to practice. Okay, I have the chance to purify negative karma now. Yeah. When we get sick, I have a chance to purify negative karma. When our mind is unhappy, I have the chance to develop compassion for people who are depressed. Yeah. When things don't go the way we want, I have the practice to develop patience and perseverance." All the time. So seeing any condition that we encounter as something that will help us along the path. Because it's true, you know, every circumstance we meet, if we know how to look at it properly, it's an opportunity to practice. Yeah. And so if we really understand that, then there's nothing that can happen where we can say, "Poor me. I can't practice." Yeah, because everything, if we know how to look at it properly, becomes an opportunity to practice. Okay. Example, you've probably heard me say this many times before. Imagine being in Tibet in 1959, and you had your monastery, your family, your whole life, your country, everything's going hunky-dory. And then, you know, within a week or two, you have to flee and leave everything. And all you have with you is your little teacup. And you're going across the Himalaya Mountains from a high altitude in, you know, where there's little disease, into a low altitude when there's plenty of bacteria and viruses. You don't know what's happened to your teachers, what happens to your family. You don't know whether you're going to be able to go back or not. You're living in a country where you don't speak the language. They put you in an old POW camp. And your friends are getting sick and you're getting sick and a lot of people are dying. Got the picture? Yeah? So this was Lama Yeshe's situation. He was 24 when he had to flee Tibet. And he would tell us the story, because he came over, you know, like right after the big uprising in Lhasa, and went to Buxar, the British POW camp, the one that Brad Pitt was in 7 years in Tibet, that camp. And so they got there and they started resuming their studies. Yeah, it was amazing. All they had was these heavy woolen clothes in India. Okay, so, and lots of people got sick and died. And Lama was telling us this story, and he said, "You know, I really have to thank Mao Zedong, because, you know, I was on my way to becoming a Geshe. I was complacent. I was happy. I probably would have been a fat, complacent Geshe, you know, just taking people's offerings, reciting things, never really understanding the real meaning of the Dharma." And he put his palms together and he said, "I really have to thank Mao Zedong, because he taught me the real meaning of the Dharma." Okay? So you see, in that kind of situation, now, it was a horrible situation, and yet he changed it so it became Dharma practice. And he really meant it. He said, he really, really meant it. He said, "Mao Zedong really taught me the purpose and meaning of the Dharma. I didn't understand it before." Okay? So you see that kind of situation. Yeah. And, you know, it's good to kind of ask yourself, if that happened to me, if, you know, in the next week we had to leave here and go somewhere else where they didn't speak our language and we had no money and no resources. Yeah. Well, how would we be thinking? Yeah. Would our mind be strong enough? Or would our mind be flexible enough? Okay. And so your mind only becomes strong by changing the way you think and really putting it in this kind of direction. And so that's why they say that bodhisattvas, they love having problems, because problems are so many good opportunities to practice. And bodhisattvas love when people criticize them. They love when people trash them behind their back, because it gives them so much opportunity to practice and to develop patience and compassion. Imagine thinking that, you know. You hear somebody saying stories about you behind your back, and you go, that's good. You know, this is going to make me more humble. This is really good for me. Can you see that? Is that true?
Yeah.
It's true, isn't it? Yeah. It's true that it's an excellent opportunity to squash our pride, and our pride certainly needs squashing, doesn't it? Doesn't it? Maybe your pride doesn't need squashing. Mine does. Yeah. So when that, you know, what a perfect opportunity to help me in my practice by squashing my pride. I should rejoice. And when somebody says bad things about me behind my back, I should go, say more. This is great. You know, I'm so attached to reputation, which is foolishness. And by criticizing me behind my back, you're helping me detach from reputation. This is really helpful. You know, say more lies about me behind my back. Can you think like that? Can you even imagine thinking like that? Can you try to think like that? Have you ever tried? When somebody's talking about you behind your back, have you ever tried thinking like that? No, yes. What's happened? What happened when you did? What happened in your mind? When you said, oh, this is great, somebody's trashing me. Yeah, your mind doesn't get upset, does it? It's true, you know, and we should really practice this. Yeah? Somebody tells us off, somebody criticizes us, you know. Thank you so much. This is really helping my practice. Yeah? Really making me get rid of this awful pride which creates so many obstacles. Because pride is a big hindrance, isn't it? You know? Our little kind of, I'm me, you should treat me well. You're so lucky to have me in your life. Yeah. I'm very good. I know everything. Well, almost. You know, that kind of attitude is such a big obstacle. Yeah? So when somebody steps on it, we should go, oh, very good, very good. Yeah. Okay, so try it. Try it when somebody does that. Try it like, oh, this is very good. Oh, you don't look like you you believe that.
Well, I've been in situations and the best I could do was not retaliate or make the person into an enemy. But later, like years later.
Years later, you could say it was good.
Yeah, I could say that was really good for me.
Yeah. At that moment, you couldn't. But years later, you could see the experience is good.
Very helpful.
Makes you grow a lot.
Yeah.
So what you want to take, having had that experience years later, is when it's happening, try and see it that way while it's happening. Yeah. Oh, this is good. I look like a complete jerk in front of all these people. This is great. Yeah? We're doing this big something, 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 you know, and I trip. Fantastic. I look at like a complete jerk. Good for me. Yeah? And why can't we laugh at ourselves? Why can't we laugh at ourselves? I've seen His Holiness sometimes right in the middle of an incredibly serious ceremony, and the Tibetan text, the pages are sometimes hard to turn, and he'll turn two pages instead of one, and he'll keep reading and it won't make sense, and he'll stop and figure out what happened and then just crack up, you know, right in the middle of giving a long, or you know, an oral transmission or something like that. We would probably just keep reading, hoping nobody noticed that we turned two pages. Okay. So another example of this, at least from my own life, is, you know, when I went to Koppan, the first year I was practicing, within a few months I had hepatitis, hep A, that you get from unclean food, you know, fruit and vegetables. And I was so sick, you know. To me, like going to the bathroom, which was the outhouse, you know, was like I might have been climbing Mount Everest for the amount of energy it took me. I mean, I was so sick. And somebody, while I was lying there, because I couldn't do anything, brought me a copy of The Wheel of Sharp Weapons by Dhamma Rakshita, and I started reading that text, and it completely transformed my whole relationship with the Dharma, because before I was always thinking I should practice the Dharma, and when I read that text I thought, I want to practice the Dharma. And so for me, looking back at that time of having HEP, I think it was a great thing that happened to me. Because if I hadn't been so sick, somebody hadn't given me that book, I would have just kind of continued on thinking, well, Dharma's good to practice. I should practice it. But, you know, not having the oomph in the practice, feeling like I really need the Dharma. But when you're sick, then sometimes you feel, I really need the Dharma. You know, this is not just like fun little things to amuse my mind, but I really need to practice because this is serious stuff. And so, you know, for me, that experience of hepatitis was a turning point, and it was a fantastic thing that happened in my practice. You know, really good. Okay, so that was the short explanation. Now, the elaborate explanation has two parts. Taking adverse circumstances into the path, one, by relying on the special thought of the awakening mind, and two, by relying on the excellent practices of accumulation and purification. So, the next section is point one there, taking adverse circumstances into the path, by relying on the special thought of the awakening mind of the bodhicitta. Okay? And so then the 7-point thought transformation text says, apply meditation immediately at every opportunity. Okay? So it doesn't say, fall asleep in your meditation session. Apply your topic of meditation 5 years from now. Okay. Well, but I know nobody here falls asleep in meditation. just doze a little bit, huh? Just a little bit? We should take lightly every physical or mental difficulty that befalls us, be it great, moderate, or slight. So not only physical problems, but also when our mind is unhappy. You know, when our mind has low energy, when our mind is distracted, when our mind is full of rubbish, when our mind just feels despair. Instead of falling into these mental states and just letting them go on, using them to practice. Okay. So whatever the circumstance, in happy times or hard times, whether we are at home or in a foreign country, in a village or a monastery, in the company of human or non-human friends, we should think of the many kinds of sentient beings in the boundless universe afflicted with similar troubles, and make prayers that our own sufferings may serve as a substitute for theirs, and that they may be parted from all misery. Okay? So we have some problem. Instead of focusing and developing our single-pointed concentration on my problem, how we usually do, is to see the boundless universe and think of how many sentient beings have this similar kind of problem right now at this very moment. And then how many of those who have this problem know the Dharma and have the Dharma techniques to help them? And how many of them, if it's a physical problem, how many of them even have access to food and medical care? So we may have some disease here. I remember when I got shingles a few months back. I was thinking, now what do you do if you're in Nepal and you're poor and you get shingles? What do you do? And I remembered, you know, taking people to clinics down the road, because sometimes I would take my Tibetan friends to clinics. Clinics are dirty. You know, the people don't usually want to go there because it's expensive by their standards. So, you know, very difficult to get good health care. I took one nun to the hospital. She had TB. In the hospital, you had to bring food to the patients. The hospital doesn't serve the food. You had to help change their bedpan. There's, you know, a dormitory bed, you know, you're sleeping in the same sheets as the person who was sick, who was there before you. Yeah, it's really quite amazing, you know. And they give you an injection, you know, you don't know if it's a sterilized needle or not. Okay, so here, you know, when we get sick, just to think about, well, what if, you know, what about people in other countries who don't have access to the kind of medical care we have? And what do they do? And then, you know, then it becomes much easier to do the taking and giving meditation. That's what this section is when it says relying on the awakening mind. You do the taking and giving meditation and say, may I take on their suffering? And may my suffering from whatever disease it is suffice for the suffering of all these other people. May they be freed of it. Some years ago, I was helping Tibetan Lama, and one of his disciples had a big tumor in his leg, big kind of crusty tumor in his leg, and he would take a piece of bone and jab it and to kind of drain the fluid and the stuff out of it from time to time. And it just got bigger and yuckier. And so we took him to the doctor. And the doctor did some surgery. He came out of the surgery in a stretcher that was kind of like a hammock with people holding the four sides. They just put him down. And, you know, we had to bring him food and things like that. And he was just so grateful for the attention that we were giving him. But, you know, the conditions there were awful. And then it wound up he had cancer. And there was no you know, cancer treatment at that hospital where he was. We were thinking that we would have to fly him to India, but he didn't know, you know, how do you get money to fly somebody to India? And he didn't know Hindi, and somebody else would have to go with him. And, you know, and it's very expensive, and where does he stay? And, you know, and you just look, and that's a very real circumstance. And he was actually fortunate because we were helping him, many people, because he had had that for a long time. And from his side, he would have just continued having it and never would have gotten it treated until it killed him, you know? So when we have some illness or ailment, if we think of these situations and think, my goodness, I'm so fortunate, you know, I just drive down the road and there's doctors and there's nurses and there's medicine and people to help me and, you know, so much support. I mean, it's just incredible. Yeah. And then really say, can the suffering I have, which seems like nothing compared to people in underdeveloped countries, but at least the suffering I have, may it suffice for theirs, may their suffering ripen upon me. Yeah. Or if we're depressed, we're in a bad mood, instead of, I'm so miserable, I'm so depressed, you know, say, wow, you know, what am I depressed about? Well, you know, one of our problems of some sort. Well, what would happen if I lived in a third world country and my children were malnourished and they were dying and I couldn't get them food and I couldn't get them, you know, medical care, and I was trying to get work, but there's war in the area where I live and I can't get the work to get the money. Yeah. And you just start thinking of real life situations that other people face, and, you know, are they, you know, they might feel despair, distress, or depression. And so you think, okay, I'm feeling bad. My feelings are hurt about something. But may I take all of their suffering upon myself? Yeah, all of their mental suffering, may it ripen on me. And my little bad mood, may it suffice for all the depression and despair and loneliness of all those other people. Okay. So you really think, I mean, just even on this planet, of what's going on, and take the suffering of others. Yeah. Let alone if you start expanding it and you think of beings born in different realms and what they're going through. Hmm. Okay, so it's quite a strong practice. Yeah. Very good practice. And this thing of always, you know, remembering other people's circumstances, it helps us put our own problem in perspective, which is often very, very important and, you know, a very strong way to change our mind. I remember the first winter retreat we did here, both of you were here, and we started the tradition of the retreatants writing to inmates. And we would get letters from some of the inmates who were doing the retreat from afar. And one guy wrote, "Well, I'm sitting in a dorm room full of 300 other people. I'm on the upper bunk, and the light bulb without a shade is about a foot and a half in front of me. And there's yelling and screaming, and people are playing music and shouting. And I just got done doing my sadhana." Yeah? Remember that? Yeah. And, you know, it was incredible because the people who were doing the retreat here didn't complain about anything. Yeah? Because you saw, oh my goodness, look at that situation that somebody's practicing in. And they're going ahead with it. Yeah? And I complain because somebody, you know, clicks their mala in the meditation hall. Yeah, I get so upset about that. You know, what would I do if I were in this situation, the dorm with 300 other people trying to do my practice? Huh? So just this thing of, you know, opening our eyes and seeing what's going on with other sentient beings. It's very good for our mind. It really cuts through the self-centered thought. I've often had the thought that every American teenager should have to spend 6 months in a third world country. Yeah. I think it would change this country dramatically if people really had the opportunity to see what went on in other places. Yeah. Or even if people, you know, went to the poor areas in our own country and spent some time. Okay? So, you know, when we have some problem, think of this situation that other people are living in and really take it upon ourselves. Yeah. And then, you know, whatever problem we have, we might be sick, we might even be very sick, you know, and have a very horrible disease. But if we do this meditation, our mind's going to be okay. Yeah. Or we might be very depressed or very distressed about something that's going on or very worried. But if we do this meditation, you know, then our mind's just going to chill out and be much calmer. Okay? So it's really something very good to practice. Considering how wonderful it is to have fulfilled the purpose of our practice of compassion by taking on the suffering of others, we should sincerely rejoice. When we do this practice and we take on their suffering and think my suffering is, you know, standing in, is sufficing for all of theirs, then really rejoice and feel happy about it. When we enjoy happiness and prosperity and suffer no lack of food, clothing, dwelling, friends, or spiritual masters, but possess these external conditions in abundance, and when suffering no internal problems, such as sudden discomfort caused by mental or physical sickness, we're able to put our faith and so on into practice. And we should recognize that all these favorable conditions for following an uninterrupted great vehicle practice in these hard times when the teaching is degenerating are the fruits of merits accumulated in the past. That was one long sentence. Okay? So, when we're enjoying happiness, when things are going well, we have enough to eat, we have a roof over our head, we have clothes, we have medicine, our mind is relatively happy, our body is relatively happy, you know, we have friends and things, and we have access to the Dharma, we have spiritual teachers who we can learn from. When we have all these good conditions, instead of taking them for granted, like we usually do, we should think, I have all these good conditions due to the merit that I created in my previous life. Okay? And so I shouldn't waste the opportunity because whoever I was in a previous life worked very hard to get the situation I have now. So I shouldn't waste the opportunity, and in fact I should use my time and energy to create more merit to ensure that I will have the same kind of opportunity again in the future, and also to progress along the path to enlightenment since I have such good conditions. Okay? Getting what I'm saying? Yeah? And so, especially in these hard times where the teaching is degenerating, you know, that we have the opportunity to study and practice in this environment, it's so incredible. And like I was saying this morning in our stand-up meeting, how we look and how people who've never been here, people who don't even know us, send us things and make donations. It's absolutely astounding, isn't it? You know, the goodness in people's hearts and the kind of faith they have. So while we have these opportunities and we have such a good situation to practice, to really use it, you know, and not take it for granted and take good, you know, use it and create merit and do purification and listen to the teachings and think about the teachings. Yeah. Because, you know, in a snap of a fingers, this whole situation could change. Yeah? Whole thing could change. It doesn't take much. The whole thing changes. Okay? So don't take it for granted, but really think, wow, what I did in a previous life was something. So I should continue this life. One of the inmates I wrote to told me that one of the things that keeps him going is he thinks, you know, whoever I was in a previous life worked really hard, so I don't want to blow it for him. You know? Because if I just blow it by having uncontrolled behavior and creating a lot of negativities, then, you know, it's like blowing somebody else's good effort. Except that was you're actually your own, but you feel like it's another person. Yeah, 'cause it was a previous life. Mm-hmm. Okay? But this is important because we really take good circumstances for granted, don't we? So much. And our mind always picks out something small to worry about, to fret about, to ruminate about, to create a problem about. You know, this is the way the deluded mind works. Yeah, one small thing and we blow it up. Okay. Therefore, it is essential to endeavor to accumulate merits on the basis of pure ethical conduct so as to obtain such uninterrupted prosperity in future lives. So we have to really create merit on the basis of having good ethical conduct. Because if you don't have good ethical conduct, how are you going to, you may do other practices to create merit, but how are you going to create merit if you don't have good ethical conduct? Yeah? How are you going to make your mind virtuous when you don't practice being virtuous? Okay? Yeah? So those who cannot see the point of this due to their having obtained even a little wealth are in many cases governed by pride, arrogance, and disdain. Okay? So people who have even a little wealth but take it for granted and who can't see the importance and necessity of creating more merit for future lives and taking advantage of the opportunity we have now, that kind of person, their mind is ruled by pride, arrogance, and disdain. In other words, they think they're above the law of karma. Yeah, I have this good these good circumstances because I'm some kind of special person and nothing bad is going to happen to me, so I don't need to try and purify and create good karma and listen to teachings and practice. You know, this came to me because, well, I'm entitled to it. That's the way we feel so often, doesn't it? I'm entitled to it. I deserve this. When these people encounter even the slightest mental or physical trouble, they become discouraged, despondent, and defeatist. And it's true, isn't it? Yeah, when you take a good situation for granted, then when you have the smallest trouble, your mind gets all out of whack. Or when you feel like you're entitled to have every good condition in the universe, when you face a little problem, then your mind just is like despondent. I can't handle it, you know. There's nothing to do. It gets defeatist. We see this, don't we? Huh? Sad. It's very sad. And it's the function of the self-centered mind. We are taught not to behave like this, but to be undisturbed whether we encounter happiness or suffering. So that's what the Dharma teachings are teaching us. To be undisturbed whether we have good external circumstances or bad ones. Okay? Whether we encounter happiness or suffering, to take them all into the path to practice. So there's time for a few questions? Yeah?
So times I've tried to do the thinking and giving, and it's, I'm going to have my much suffering going on. Doesn't mm-hmm. really seem to do much. It seems in this teaching you're saying that's really more the time where you should be appreciating your situation.
Mm.
And I'm thinking that you should be able to do that practice with more of a heartfelt sense.
Yeah.
Remember your mind is happy.
Okay. So you're saying that when you do the taking and giving practice when you're unhappy and having problems, it works much better than when you're happy. But it seems like you should be able to do it equally well when you're happy and things are going well. And that's true. We should be able to do that. So then the question comes, how do we get our mind in the state where it's going to be really affected by things when we're happy and things are comfortable? And I think here, thinking about how our circumstance could change at any minute, that can kind of wake us up. And also, I find what's very helpful is I start looking at other people and other living beings and really look in their hearts and see their suffering and then think, you know, in a snap of fingers, this could be my suffering. And especially, I look at the kitties and I think, you know, what would it be like to be born as an animal? You know, here you are within a Dharma environment, but you can understand what's going on. Yeah, you can't appreciate it. All you want to do is sleep all day or eat, you know. And the mind that's like so overwhelmed by ignorance that can't think straight, that doesn't, you know, to me, it's very scary to have that kind of mind. Yeah, that knows what we're talking about. It's very scary to have that kind of mind. And so then I think that there's living beings, you know, that I even care about who have that kind of state of mind. And wow, you know, I should do something. I want to do something. And that in a snap of fingers, it could be my state of mind too. So that really wakes me up. Yeah. Have you ever, you know, when you walk down the road and you see the cows or the horses, just look in their eyes and think, you know, there's a sentient being in there who, you know, used to be a human being and could talk and read and think of all these things. And now just look, you know, they're stuck in this body. And the whole potential of the mind is trapped. And how do they even create the good karma to get out of it when you have that situation? Yeah? So I find doing this, or, you know, the bugs in the room, look at, this is the year time of year when we have stink bugs. Look at them, you know, or the crickets. Yeah, or the chipmunks. Yeah, and the squirrels. To me, you know what the squirrels are? You know how your mind gets so distracted? Because the squirrels are really jerky, aren't they? They're always this and then, and you watch them. Watch them, you know? And it's like they're so impulsive and can't stay on anything and very jerky. And I think, my goodness, what would it be like to have that kind of mind? Yeah. And I mean, I have a taste when my energy gets jerky and uncontrolled, but theirs is like 100 times worse. And no opportunity to learn the Dharma.
Or the coyotes.
Yeah, or the coyotes. Yeah, howling and hunting, or the turkeys. Turkeys were so afraid of being alone. Yeah. Yeah. Terrified of being alone. Yeah.
Question online.
Uh-huh.
How do nuns get more opportunity to practice, such as with difficult people, when they are in an environment where mindfulness is a lifestyle?
Where mindfulness is what?
A lifestyle.
Okay. So how do Sangha members have the opportunity to practice being with difficult people and difficult situations when you live in an environment where mindfulness is a lifestyle? Well, theory- theoretically, mindfulness is a lifestyle, but you know, we're just ordinary human beings, aren't we? Yeah? And we're just ordinary human beings trying to make mindfulness and compassion a lifestyle, but we have a ways to go. So internally, we have the afflictions, and then we live with each other, don't we? Yeah? And so we live with plenty of people that drive us nuts. You know, I love it the way, you know, these kinds of questions. Because, you know, the people have the idea that when you live in a monastery, everybody thinks alike, everybody acts alike, everybody keeps the precepts the same way. So you're all very harmonious. Not exactly like that, you know, because our afflictions come right with us into the monastery, don't they? Our berserking mind's right there with us. And you have to live with people who in your ordinary life you probably wouldn't associate with. Yeah, because we're very different people with different ways of doing things, different ways of thinking. We might all have the same spiritual faith, but boy, we still have different personalities and different ways of doing things. And you have to live with those people 24/7. You can't go home and be with your family who loves you and who says, oh, you're wonderful and it's their fault. Nobody here does that to each other, yeah? So we have to sit there and, you know, learn to live with each other. So that's why they say that living in a monastery is like rocks being in a tumbler, that you polish each other and chip off your rough edges. Yeah. It can be a challenge, can't it? But it's an incredible circumstance for growing, because you're always faced with your own mind. Because you know here, as soon as you start pointing the finger and he made me mad, she did this, you know as soon as you start doing that you're wrong. You know, it's like this is a place where you try and do that and it doesn't fly. Does it? We keep trying, but it doesn't fly. Pointing the finger at another person doesn't fly. So we're always in a situation where we have to look back and, you know, what's going on in my mind? What am I thinking? What energy am I putting out? And am I seeing things accurate? Am I being kind and respectful and so on? Oh, you know, I remembered, because we were going to think about getting taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay, we're over time for now, so we better stop. But let's hold this and then talk about it next week, about getting taken advantage of. Did you think about it a bit? Yeah. Okay, so keep thinking, and then next week I'll have to give myself a post-it so I remember at the beginning of the session instead of the end.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all our inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Nirangarana mandalakam niryatayami.
Due to this merit, may we soon
attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious body, mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born of no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful, tending, gyatso, chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of
explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the ten directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Glory.